Okay.
So, damn, it doesn't fire me.
That's okay. I'll just walk up to the table anyway. It's okay. So there are a number of challenges that come with giving a share on this topic, some of which are personal, some of which are objective. The objective challenge that many of you have already got by referring to the George Carlin routine, you can also get it from Monty Python, which is the challenge, right, if you're giving a share about words you're not allowed to say, right, so two things can happen. Either you can have the Monty Python routine, which for those of you who know in Life of Brian is where they attempt to have a trial for somebody using the name of God in vain, but the problem is every time they mention what the trial is about, the judge gets stoned. Now this is a problem already, that one of the several places in which Monty Python seems to be aware of certain Gemaras. Gemara addresses the same question in terms of cursing God as opposed to in terms of mentioning God's name in vain. The alternative, you don't actually mention it, so the Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Mishnah in Sanhedrin suggests the way you do it is by having great moments of intensity. It only gets said once. Somebody said once, everyone tears their clothing and goes on the ground. Or you end up with the George Carlin routine in which you spend your entire time with everyone wondering if you're going to slip up and say the word by mistake and you come as close as possible. Neither of those seem to me like the right way to give a shiur on the subject. So we have to deal with that as a reality that it's tough to. That it's hard to give a share without being able to mention exactly what you're talking about. I also want you to. I think that the Monty Python thing about taking God's name in vain is an important starting point because it makes clear that there are two possible reasons that you might not be allowed to say something. One possibility is that it's too profane. The other possibility is that it's too sacred. And one of the issues that comes up is which of the Right, with regard to particular areas of language, which of these is the problem? It's not entirely clear which is which. The second is a personal issue. So here, I'll just I very I think I said to Tal somewhere today, right? Today, like working out the shiur is it's a way of coming to terms with my own adolescence belatedly. And then I asked, like, how do they understand it? They said there are two possible ways. Either you were the kind of kid who did, in fact, use nibble pad all the time and you're trying to come to terms with that retrospectively, or the kind of kid who didn't and you're trying to come to terms with the social consequences of that retrospectively. It's the second. I was wholly, wholly intolerant. I had an allergic reaction to profanity when I was in high school, so allergic that I actually left one high school and went to another in order to avoid it. And that's a reasonable position. But I have to say, and here's this is a you know an etchata ayani maskir that one thing that brought home to me that perhaps that was being a little bit disproportionate is that I had a student who certainly did not share my feelings on the subject and was not so good at being on a 7-second delay even in a Torah classroom at one point in Maimonides, and student took directly after. Student's father, who I therefore had real trouble with, and it wasn't, and that was, so I was not successful with that student. I wasn't successful with the family in some ways, although with other members of the family I was. And it wasn't until I was at the student's father's shiva that when I understood, first of all, the father had been a physician who largely dealt with dying children and lived under just radical emotional stress the entire day. And at the shiva, I recognized that I had been just wholly disproportionate. And maybe this was his way of dealing with the just incredible, crazy suffering he was dealing every day. And that made me try and revisit the question and see if I was not overreacting in some way without trying to undermine the holy sewer. I also want to say that there's a social context here, which is almost never referred to halachically, but which it seems to me it would be dishonest not to acknowledge. The social context is age. Right? So no one has ever, to my knowledge, really set up halachic frameworks which say there are things you can do when you are 19 and when you can't do when you're 13. But societies are often structured to set up absolute bans. For the most obvious example in our society is drinking, right? Where we set up a ban on drinking up to age 21, But we expect, but we sort of expect that that will happen afterwards. So for some reason, right, we expect, right, we set this up societally in terms of, we set up in terms of depictions of sexuality in movies, right, where we have age limits for R-rated movies and things, right, and PG-rated movies and things like that. And we also probably, I would say, it's a fair social context that people say that teenagers shouldn't say that and things like that, and which is very hard for teenagers to deal with because they know their parents do it on occasion. And the question, right, and there seems to be some notion of age appropriateness that has cultural significance that, right, has never played any kind of role in halakha, and it's worth thinking about why that might or might not be. Okay, that's the background context. Let's take a look at some primary sources on the subject and see what we deal with. So the first one, probably the most famous, and maybe one of the most famous texts in contemporary modern orthodoxy for various reasons, the Ramban on Vayikra Yud Tet Beit. That's certainly, what shaped the first time I was ever taught about this subject, always in the context of extremely colorful diatribes against Nivul Peh. They all come from this Ramban. Right, the Ramban says that there's a prohibition called Kedoshim to you, and let's look exactly how he frames it. He says, in my opinion, as opposed to Rashi, right, Rashi says that Kedoshim to you shall be holy refers to not engaging in forbidden sexual relationships. Right? So Rashi teaches it as a general rule that adds nothing to the previous list of prohibitions. It's just a way of giving you a conceptual framework, right, for sexual prohibition. But Ramban says, I think that's wrong. I think that you shall be holy doesn't refer to forbidden sexual relationships. It refers to permitted sexual relationships. And not just permitted sexual relationships, but permitted foods, eating meat and wine. Because, he says, this is the same as mine, it therefore turns out that a person of appetite, a Baal Taibet, can find room to be immersed in eros with his wife or many wives, and to be among the gluttons of meat and wine, and to speak as he wishes in all nivalot, as this prohibition is not mentioned in the Torah, and thus he will be a naval birshut haTorah, a naval within the confines of the Torah. So this phrase, right, becomes a catch-all. Should I say where it ends, right, where you end up saying that uses of inappropriate language fall into this broad classification of things that offend our sense of holiness. And then, of course, that becomes subjective, like things that offend our sense of Shabbos. Right? Some things work and some things don't for people, things that offend our sense of decency, all sorts of things like that. Is there anything that Ramban is doing that is that's more significant than just coming up with a catch-all? So actually, if you look at it, it's really, right, you'll see that he actually has a very complicated move in the next paragraph. He says, therefore, Scripture comes after a detail. So the first thing he says is, it details the prohibitions that are asur legamre, that are completely forbidden. So what are these things? What does it mean to be incompletely forbidden? Right, you think that's a little bit pregnant, right? To be incompletely forbidden. Not clear what he means by asur legamre. And he gives a general command that we should be prushim min hamutar, we should be separated from the permitted, including that a person should guard his mouth and tongue from being defiled by much overeating and disgusting speech. So inappropriate speech now is in the same, right, it's the same category as overeating. Interesting move. Yes, Mrs. Clapper.
Does that mean I can use a little bit inappropriate?
That's a very interesting question. So one of the immediate challenges in Ramban is that he puts Nivul Peh in the category of things that, right, that are permitted, but you shouldn't overuse. Right, and
well, he says Ribui Ha'achila Agasa.
Right.
Bu means Hadibur Hanimas.
Right. Okay.
He doesn't say Ribui Hadibur Hanimas.
Good. All right. So we have a problem. That's an excellent statement of the problem. On the one hand, he seems to say this as an absolute, and on the other hand, it's parallel to a whole set of categories, right, in which we say that a little bit is okay, right, but too much is not good. And so we don't know exactly how to match that. Yes.
So I understood when he says Yidaber b'chol ha-nevelot, nevelot, that nevelot is referring back to the other things, and it's sort of within the categories of forbidden sexual relations, forbidden foods, etc. Don't think you can sort of enjoy them vicariously by talking about them.
Ah. So really, we should have, right, so if we were to do a routine, it would be, it would include words like cheeseburger.
Yes.
right? Which does not say words
but
like cheeseburger or pork or things like that.
But
I don't know. That's a bit of a push, I think. I don't know. You know, my brother-in-law was very fond of mentioning. My brother-in-law bans the mention of any word associated with chametz other than chametz on Pesach in his house, right? So you can't say donut. So you know. It's possible that's what it's referring to. It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that's really what Ramban means. For me at least.
That's
yes.
I'm saying not to say the word, but oh, I wish I could have that lobster right now.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you think that Nivlut Peh is totally a matter of content and not a matter of language?
Yes.
Okay, that's also a very important point. Right? It's also a very important point that Ramban never defines what he means by Nivlut Peh.
Have you defined?
I did not define it at all either. Now there is a risk here when you try and this is the First Amendment risk, right? When you know, the disastrous Lewis Powell decision in which he decided that sanity couldn't be defined, but that you knew it when you saw it, which ended up requiring the Supreme Court to watch all movies that were challenged on obscenity grounds on what's called First Amendment Day at the Supreme Court. definitions, they're always either too narrow, in which case people end up with George Carlin routines, or they're too precise, or they're too broad, in which case you're not really saying anything.
Are we talking about sexual talk, or are we talking about...
I know, David thinks it's talk about these forbidden things, which means sexual talk, and talk about
the wrong person.
About Trey Food.
Sounds like you can be as explicit as you like about what.
No, you can't be, because you can't. He objects to even to overindulgence with your wife.
No. But in David's universe, you can talk about your sex with your wife.
Not too much, I think.
It's like you can say hot dog, right? You just can't say cheeseburger.
I don't want to go there. I really don't. That's right. There's no way to avoid this risk. Okay. Okay. Therefore, Scripture comes after it details the prohibition that it completely forbade and gives a general command that we should separate it from the permitted, including that he should guard his mouth and tongue from being defiled by much overeating and disgusting speech, as this verse says, in every mouth speaking nivalah, that didn't help us define it, and sanctify himself in this until he reaches prishut, as they said of Rabbi Chia, shekol yamav lo saf sicha betelo. Okay, so now Ramban puts this on a continuum, right? That nivul peh is just an extension of the general category of unnecessary speech, or evanescent speech that has no eternal purpose. And that goes back to what we did last week, right? Where really the framework we start with is that all speech has to be justified, and some speech is really, really not justified, and some speech really. But Ramban doesn't really have. That's what it says. Ramban doesn't really have a precise definition of the category, nor does he make clear ever whether the issue is content or language. And if you were just to read him, it would sound like a prohibition against content as opposed to language. And that would be my first page sense. Yes.
I just want to say, given the first book that was there beforehand about what is nivul peh negid overeating, it's especially seen from that last time, and also from the fact that he includes it in the first paragraph, that talking any nivul peh is also like overeating vessel because it's an extension, because it's like overeating to potato conversation.
That nivul peh is just an intensification of worthless talk.
Exactly. Therefore,
right.
It's like overeating.
Okay, but something is some kind of eating is mutter, so some kind of
sticha b'teila.
Aha, okay,
but
good. So let's hold it. Maybe we'll get back there. Okay, yes, right, Sandra.
Do we translate it as motarot or mutarot? How do you translate it?
I have to go back and look at the Hebrew. I think it's mutarot.
I would say.
Yeah.
So it becomes an issue of really of the question of excess. This fits into a Rambam's spiel of the Hab type concept, into Aristotelian and Stoic kind of thoughts of that the real problem is excess in anything. So then the problem nivul peh, is it an excess or is it a category in and of itself? When he puts it within sicha b'teila, and I think that would be why he's thinking within sicha b'teila, because in other words, that's unnecessary excessive speech. In other words,
right.
So he's locating within that issue of excess.
I think that's a reasonable reading, but you know, it's not the intuitive. We don't usually, like, what's not excessive. So it's just, it's an intensification of speech that has no purpose. It's not that there's something terrible about it, right? It's just, you know, but on the other hand, it uses the categories like nimas, disgusting,
yeah.
Right? So I'm not,
it stands out in a strange way, because all of his other categories are excess. I mean,
yeah.
Too much wine, too much meat, and that, but this one actually is a bit unique. He did a little sleight of hand included in Sita Bateva, which he says, but it actually has a quality of its own that's not expressed by the notion.
I agree. I don't think I know exactly where it's going. Okay, a very different perspective, I think, is offered by the Rambam. Right, so the Rambam says, right, you already know, who ironically doesn't put this in the Shulchan Aruch at all. Right, so it says, you already know the great prohibition against nivlut peh, which also is necessarily the case, meaning that even though it's prohibited formally by the Torah, it's logically necessary that it should be forbidden also. Because it says speech in language, right, the capacity to speak in words, is among the treasures of humankind, and a tova, a beneficence bestowed upon Adam by God, so as to separate him from the other creatures. Right? And he quotes Psukim that he understands as meaning that the uniqueness of humanity is the capacity for speech. And it is obviously wrong for us to use this beneficence, this tova, which God gave us for our self-perfection, in order to achieve shleimut, to teach and learn about the greatest of lacks and the complete shame. Right, which now, right, which to him means, right, which the point that we say what the stupid vulgar Gentiles say in their poems and typical words, that's his language, rather than like one to whom it was said, and you shall be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy people. Anyone who uses his thought or his speech with regard to that sense which is a shame to us, so that he thinks about drinking or about sex more than is necessary for him, or recites poems about it, has already taken the beneficence which Hashem gave him and used it as an aid to rebel against his benefactor and to transgress his commandments. And he's about the whom Scripture said, right? God says, I gave you silver and gold, and what did you do? You made idols out of the silver and gold. Okay, so the Rambam puts this in a very specific philosophic framework, right? He believes that the sense of touch, particularly, is gross, and you right, it's the furthest, right? It sort of manifests our corporeality. It makes us material beings as opposed to intellectual beings in the most dramatic way. And so any time you think about physical pleasures that emerge, right, that emerge from touch, and for him eros is this, right, the capacity to feel erotic desire, is a shame. Right? So speech is not so much the issue. Speech is just a reflection of thought. And, right, and for him, nivul peh is taking language which God gave you to talk about philosophy and using it to talk about sex more than is necessary. Okay, now that's a very, right, then the Rambam goes further and he says, I further have an argument and cause for our language being called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language. Don't think this is hyperbole or error, rather it is truth. I don't know whether you're of the opinion. Some people, I think whatever the Rambam says, don't think this is hyperbole. Of course it is. But right, you can make your own opinion about this. Because this holy language contains no noun at all for genitalia, neither male nor female, nor for the procreative act itself, nor for semen, nor for excretions. All these have no primary noun in Hebrew, but rather they are spoken of via borrowed nouns and hints. The intent of this was to indicate that these things should not be mentioned, that they should be nouns, but rather they are topics that one must be silent regarding, and when the need arises to mention them, one should engage in subtlety using euphemisms from other languages. Right, so that is the justification for Yiddish, I guess.
But only for the bad words.
That's the only justification for Yiddish. I always remember it would be a wonderful, you know, somebody who talks, right, somebody, you know, who romances his wife in French and discusses philosophy in German and writes tragedy in Greek and argues with his wife in Yiddish. That was the classic. I'm not a Yiddishist. I know that there's, I'm probably insulting lots and lots of Yiddishists. It's a wonderful, beautiful language. But, all right, yes.
Is this problem speaking true?
So I do not wish to, we'll talk about it. I'm not particularly interested in whether it's true or not. Or hyperbole, or whatever. I'm not pretty interested, because he can always claim any words you find are just loan words from some other language.
Isn't that true of all words?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how meaningfully. Yeah, if you want to claim there is an original language, right, which is what Adam HaRishon spoke,
yeah.
And that was Lashon HaKodesh, and all these other words are borrowed. Now, what Adam HaRishon did, they didn't have other language to borrow from, I'm lost. After means al-bavel, right? So then, right, you know, I got words, I don't know. I don't have a capacity to deal with it. Okay? Just, now here's an interesting one. He says, just as we are as private as we're able to be when the need arises to actually engage in them. Okay, so the Rambam has a general theory, but first of all, right, he thinks that Nivul Peh is speaking about things that are really, really physical. And then he says that, well, we have a concept of tsniut regarding these things, when, right, regarding these things when we actually do them, so why shouldn't we also have a concept of tsniut about these things when we talk about them? Right, and therefore, right, so he has a double category. He says, A, the content should be minimized, and B, when you are compelled to deal with the content, then you should, right, then you should draw some kind of linguistic veil over them. Whether it works or not to draw a linguistic veil is a separate question. Right, whether if you have a language that has no such words, when, whether every verb becomes a double entendre, which to some degree does happen, because of that is a secondary question. But okay, Rambam has a theory. It does in which basically the whole issue of Nivul Peh is physicality, and then he has a metaphor for why certain words are worse than others. Now his metaphor is only, right, his metaphor of tsniut only explains when you have the use of euphemisms as opposed to actual words. It doesn't explain the use of different, right, why in a standard culture, in many cultures, there are two words to refer to the same phenomenon, and one of them is considered dirty and one of them is not, even though there is no ambiguity, right, about each of them. Right, so that, right, that I think is a weakness in the description. And he also, I think, doesn't really relate to an issue which I think needs to be brought up, is that really, there really are two uses of certain kinds of language. One is as a description of the thing you're actually describing, and the other is just as a marker of intense emotion. Right? And the word doesn't mean the same thing. It really doesn't mean the same thing. And it's almost certainly not a coincidence that the terms for expressing extreme emotion in most cultures, I think, are the same. They're, right, there are very few cultures that use the eating of cheeseburgers. Right? You talk about eating cheeseburgers in a state of extreme emotion. Right? You know, where people just kind of say, by golly, Big Mac! it just doesn't happen that way. So, you know, so that I think needs some kind of analysis. Yes, Elliot?
But, I mean, people do express extreme emotion using beautiful language, I mean.
Yeah.
So, how much of those words are necessary to express extreme emotion? Because I can think of two other ways. Either, if I'm very talented at writing, I know that I see extreme emotion presented in beautiful language,
mm-hmm.
or by non-language, that I'm in so much pain, I just cry out and I say, ow, which isn't really a word.
Right, so I'm not saying that it's necessary. I'm just saying that it doesn't. It's not the same thing. Right, it's not right. It's not at all right. The use of language like that is not at all the same thing as right as deliberately going out and describing an action in the most vulgar terms you can find in the most right gross form. Yes, right.
Practically, the Ramban and the Rambam don't seem so different, because the Rambam also thinks that, you know, Rambam thinks that eating is embarrassing, you know, something to be ashamed of, and that, you know, probably that we should be eating in private. And, you know, all these other things that, you know, end up being, that for us seem normal, but for him, anything of a physical nature is something that you should be ashamed of and shouldn't be discussed.
Okay,
I guess for the Rambam, more of a spectrum, maybe, depending on how you read it, but for the Rambam, it ends up being very similar.
Okay, good. Yes.
Is the Rambam's basis for the reason why discussion of sexuality should be private or seen or whatever it is, is because it relates to the physical body, then is he going to have the same reaction to my, you know, talking about how delicious the chicken is?
Yeah.
Or did you feel the baby's skin is so soft? And does that mean he has a totally different sense of what's inappropriate than we do?
You know, I don't want to, I can't say for sure, but again, the continuum, the same way that it's rather peculiar to us, I think, intuitively, that Ramban puts us on the same scale as overeating. Right, so I think that, yeah, it's very likely that for the Rambam, this is part of the same continuum as writing the wine column. I think so. unless you write it purely as an abstract exercise, as I would, for example. You know, I read the wine column times for years. After I loved the writing, I never actually tasted any wine other than Malaga. And I had no expectation of ever doing it, but I just thought the right, you know, I read the wine column, friends who read the bridge column just because they were the best written columns. Even though I had no idea what on earth any of them referred to. So it was kind of like learning Eridea in Smeitha. But I actually have having seen an animal.
It was a Corcovado.
Yes. I did actually have to watch a Shlita though, eventually, but now it's not quite as bad. I don't remember it happily though. Okay, now let's take a look at source number three. So this, Gemara Sanhedrin, Kuf Aleph and Aleph says, there's a Braita, and one who reads a verse from Shir HaShirim and makes it a kind of song, and one who reads a verse in a drinking house not at its time, brings bad evil into the world, because I have this fun dialogue, the Torah wears sackcloth and stands before God and says, your children have made me like a harp played upon by, you know, by musicians in a bar. Right, that's what I am. And so God says, well, what should they be talking about while they're eating and drinking? And the answer is not entirely clear. Right? Basically, they should be learning Torah, but they are learning Torah. They're quoting Sukkim.
No, they're using the Torah as song.
Yeah, and God says, what should they be talking about? The answer is they should be talking about Torah.
They should be talking about the ideas of Torah. God gave you this Torah, God gave you this holy Torah to learn from, and you're making it into a pop song.
And you have seasonal correctness.
It's also, I mean, they do use the Kiyakiri, and that's also very explicit working, and so maybe that's... And when it says, I could pasuk of Beit Mishkaot, maybe it's a pasuk directly related to Beit Mishkaot.
Well, presumably, the reason people pick songs from Shir HaShirim is because, you know, there is... Because they are songs that relate to topics that are popular, you know, they're popular in drinking houses, right? And you don't, you know, there are fewer songs from Kohelet, although, you know, there is one famous one.
By the birds?
Yes, by the birds. a time to,
yeah.
Right? Right, now we've done it.
the parallel version of this brayta Rabasi explicitly says that Heichi Dami Kimin Zemer Zashar B'Choshe B'Hirur. Right, I mean it's explicit there that the issue at hand is that you're singing psukim from Shir HaShirim or Shir HaShirim or other psukim depending on what you think the right, the parameters are of this brayta, and you're thinking about sexual thoughts. I mean, that's explicit in the version of Kabbalah.
Sure, sure. I'm fine with all that. Right. What I just want to point out is, Shir HaShirim discusses these topics in some way, very vaguely, whatever. But we say that and the reason that you can't use Shir HaShirim for that purpose. It's not because you're not allowed to think about it. It's because you're not allowed to think about it. You're not allowed to take Shir HaShirim and turn it into something which is just about that. Right, so what I set out is that there are two different categories, and we need to figure out how to relate them. One is called profaning the sacred, and the other is sanctifying the profane. Those are different categories. What happens, particularly in the realm of sexuality, so the Rambam sets it up that there's nothing whatsoever about sexuality that deserves talking about. Right? Really? Right? The sense of shame. Right? And so, what's wrong with vulgar speech about sexuality is that it has you thinking about sexuality when you should be thinking about Torah. But the Gemara has a very different sense, right? Which is that sexuality is a metaphor for the most, right, the most sacred religious metaphor we have. And to take the most sacred metaphor we have and cheapen it by making it only, right, about physicality is inappropriate. And those are two radically distinct, right? Those are two radically distinct notions of what the issue is. Is the issue that this shouldn't be a topic, or is the issue, right, because it's too bad, it's too worthless? Or is the issue that this is something that, right, you can't take it off its perch, right? As is this parallel to a prohibition against, right, against the using scatological language, or the prohibition against mentioning, right, against pronouncing God's name? Right, those are two very, very different perspectives, which I think emerge from the Gemara. Now, We have more problems here. Let's look at the Gemara and Megillah, Daf 25b, which I'm sure many of you were jumping at as soon as you read the Rambam claim that there are no terms, right? There are no terms for any of these things in Tanakh. So the Gemara and Megillah quotes a Braita, which essentially says there's a whole set of verses which use language that would not be permitted in PG-ready films, right? And we have them as Kriya Ktiv, right? And they're right on mark, right?
Someone mentions
Sure. I think the Rambam would just claim these are foreign loan words, right? It's not a problem for him.
No, he claims that they are also euphemisms.
No, he claims that we might write them, but we never say them, and that's important to know.
Okay, so Gemara's going to say this right now. Gemara has a debate about whether you write. But the words exist, definitely. The words exist. Right? And if for the Rambam, saying them doesn't matter so much, we're not supposed to think them either. Right? His whole point is that speech is just an expression of thought. Right, if you spent your time, right, you know, reciting things in the background, you had no idea what they meant, or you had your mind off it, it wouldn't matter in the slightest. Yes.
But it seems there are a couple of levels to the Rambam, because even though he'll define each of these ones as euphemisms, so like there's levels of euphemisms, like so directly referring to the act we should never do, and then like close euphemisms we can read but not speak, and then distant euphemisms we can even speak.
Maybe, I don't know. That's a nice halachic scheme. I'm not sure that I know if it's true. Yes, right.
This might be all over my head. Where are these psukim, and I guess how are you translating these words?
So tishagelna is an extremely vulgar word for sex, and chorim is a word for excrement. And that seems
chorim
to be
hemorrhoid.
Yeah, or whatever. Right. So sorry, I don't know which word it is.
But chorim is the cray. Chorim is the.
I forget which one it is. Whatever it may be, right? They're exactly the words you expect them to be.
Where are these?
The Hebrew gives you the psukim, doesn't it?
Yeah. Varim, Malafim,
Ishaya. And they're exactly where you expect them to be, right? You expect them to be, you know, where, right? And when you are a conqueror, then your wives will be, right?
The ketiv is written in a modest way.
The other way around.
Ketiv is written in modest way.
But we don't read them out loud.
We're more firm than God.
It's a way, you know. I'll say where this Lahavdil. But I know like where this came up for me in college. I think it was like a very interesting test. Was in an English literature class in Yeshiva University, where we were reading Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl. All right, excerpt. And there's a moment, right, in that poem, you know, and so happens, I suspect it probably happens regularly, that, you know, somebody is assigned to read the poem who forgot to do the reading the night before, or did reading, and all the, you know, and starts reading along, and all of a sudden they get to the line, which has a four-letter word, and you have this sudden decision, what do I do? Right, does it, you know, do I read it, do I not read it? It's not the same poem without it. Right, it's not a poem that works with darn and heck. It's interesting to watch, and then you have conversations, and it's really interesting to watch how people make that decision. First of all, you can make the decision that this poem shouldn't be assigned to Yeshiva University. Right? You can just make that decision. That's the reason, right? You know, and you know, this is the Catcher in the Rye debate to some degree, except that I think Howl's a lot better than Catcher in the Rye. It's just my opinion. I was that kind of teenager. I didn't see myself in Catcher in the Rye at all. I just hated it. But Howl, on the other hand, Howl I thought was a great poem. So there were some of us who read it silently but would never say the word out loud, and some people who would say the word out loud in class but never anywhere else. And it was a really interesting way, and it's parallel to this notion of why are there words written in, we read, you know, when you read the ketiv in your head, right, you're thinking about these things, and yet you don't read them. That's a complicated...
That's the opposite of Rambam.
It doesn't seem to fit so well with Rambam, except, you know, the Rambam has this scheme of modesty, right?
But he said you don't talk about it so that you won't think about it.
But except when it's necessary. Yeah. So I have to figure out what necessary means. Everyone concedes necessary. Ideally, it wouldn't be necessary at all, though. That's in his scheme. There's no... Ramban, it's not so clear. Ideally, it's not necessary at all. Ramban, it may very well be, as Rabbi Sander suggested, that these things are necessary, but in moderation. And once you get out of moderation, it's problematic. Okay, the Gemara then goes on to say, right, and you know that that using this kind of language is late tanuta, right, is the you know is the behavior of people who have no sense of value. But there are circumstances in which you're allowed to do it, right? You can come up with scatological insults for for idolatry and idolaters. And the Gemara gives all sorts of interesting examples where verses are darshans in ways where you know that otherwise innocent verses become claims become excremental claims about idolaters and idolatry. You know, perhaps the most famous measure from this sort is the notion that Baal Peor, right, is involves a religion in which people excrete it for the sake of worship. Right, and that's that you want to take it as history, great, but more likely it's a way of making really, really funny, you know, it's a really, really funny satire. Right, you know, that's where the Jews went so far in the religion, they went that far. And then it says, right, you know, people who have sustained negative reputation of sexuality, you can insult them by calling them son of a prostitute. Right, probably not using the euphemism. Right, although the Gemara already does, right, it has the gimel word and the shin word, right, so all the things that we know about. Right, that's what the Gemara says. You can humiliate him by saying gimel and shin. So here too, the Gemara seems to believe that as opposed to an absolute prohibition, it depends on context. Then we have this wild Gemara in Brachot that's famous in any number of contexts, in which Rav Kahana goes to sleep under Rav's bed, and Rav's wife is in his bed with him. And here's Rav engaging in playful conversation, presumably erotic conversation with his wife, before, and now the Gemara uses a euphemism. Right, presumably he's under the bed at a highly inappropriate time. And then he has a chutzpah, he comes out and he repudiates his teacher for speaking frivolously. What were you doing?
Isn't the word speaking here a euphemism itself?
No. He hears him engaging in erotic conversation.
You think it's conversation and not...
Yeah, and then the act happens.
Well, I think conversation itself is a euphemism.
No, I don't think so. I don't think... But we can... I don't think so. I think there's a series of words, but can't... and he says to him, like, you know, you're talking about this if it matters. Right? So he says, you sound like somebody... Right, somebody, you know, right, it's not like you're expressing desire. You sound like somebody who never knew that food could be cooked, which is itself a sexual euphemism, right? Because cooking food is a sexual euphemism in rabbinic literature. And so Rav says, "Out, get out." The right answer. Absolutely the right answer.
You can come back.
Right, Hedrick says, Torah, he's a little bit of Torah. Yeah, the Torah. Pardon?
He's playing around.
The Sodom part is
talking. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, right, so the problem we have is here is Rav, right, what's Rav doing? Right, why isn't Rav Kahana's critique right? Okay, Gemara Shabbat, page 33 doesn't seem to have anywhere near the same tolerance that was. As a result of Asina Nivlut Peh, many troubles and hard decrees originate. And so here we have yet another euphemism, right? Whenever we talk about destruction of the Jews, in the rabbinic literature, it becomes the haters of the Jews. Right? So name Shal Yisrael. So euphemism has a purpose. Right? One of the interesting things, it seems, that the Talmud is perfectly comfortable with the notion that you can separate form from content. And it matters what form you use to express the content. Right, because we can say the enemies of the Jews will be destroyed. We can't say the Jews will be destroyed, even though everybody knows it means, right? It means the enemies of the Jews. Right, widows cry out in our orphan. There's a long verse talking about how badly God reacts to Mal speaking to Bala. And then it says, right, what does it mean? And his hand is still outstretched. So Hanan Barava says, everyone knows why the bride enters the chuppah, but anybody who's menabel his mouth, even if he has a sealed heavenly decree for 70 good years, they reverse it to bad. And the Rabbi Rashela says, that's not even enough, right, that not only that, they dig Gehenim deeper for him. And Nachum Bar Yitzchok says, not only for the person who said it, but even for anybody who listens. So this is a very interesting description of Nivlut Peh. Right? Nivlut Peh here is not about making people think about things they don't know about. It's about saying things that are obvious, right? It's about expressing in language things that are obvious, but that you're not supposed to mention. Okay, which is yet another conception. Right? Everybody knows it. right? But you don't mention it. Because people live life.
Does somebody told their children about it?
Somehow. I don't know.
It's the first greatest
one. Yes,
it is. I always understood this Gemara as not like, you know, talking about this in a teaching context. Because, yes, obviously the facts of life have to be explained at some point. But sort of like making jokes about it.
Yeah, I assume that's right. You're at the wedding, right? The wedding is not the time to suddenly educate it, right? If you have, you know, suddenly educate, right? There's no purpose. The wedding, you're right, you're talking about, right? You're talking about walking down the aisle. And those things don't get mentioned. But even though, you know, everyone knows. Now this, right, this idea, right, and Rashi says explicitly, right, so no need to explain. Now this same idea shows up in Breishit Rabbah, which is then quoted by Rashi, right, where there's this verse in Chumash, in Breishit, where Yaakov seems to be exactly this, right? Yaakov says to Laban, Hava et ishti ve'avoa eleha. Right, which is about as explicit as you can get in biblical Hebrew that doesn't use the words that we've talked about. And Rav Abel says, what is Yaakov doing? Right, Yaakov's behaving boorishly. And so he gives an answer. He says, well, God said to me, what he really meant to say is, God said I will establish 12 tribes. I don't do it now, when? Right, if I don't do it now, when? Okay, so what? So what? Why does that justify it? Why does it justify framing it that way? Right? Yaakov could just have said, Havei dishti shani tarish panim. Right? That would have been fine.
Because he doesn't know that he'll get from you. Because that's in the hand of God.
Eshtadel, you know, there are ways to do it. You don't, the avoe lea is crude. Isn't that right? There aren't any other, I don't think there's any way around that. Better than Deshkavata, but...
Maybe Yaakov Avinu wasn't always Yaakov Avinu. He also went through an immature period in his life.
He's not so young anymore. He's not so young. He's not so young. I actually do have a poem about this, but not for now. Okay, now the Erechat Tzadikim, just in case, you know, just as contrast, and also because I wanted to use the word hapify in an English translation. I couldn't think of any other way of doing Mesameach. Right, so it was fun to use the word hapify. Right, so he says, right, he says not only that, when you're being Mesameach the Chatan and Kalam, make sure you don't use Nivlut, because then God gets very angry. Okay, now the Afrikasta D'Anya, which is some Shuvah Sefer, right, has a really interesting approach to this. He says is, the words of Rav Kahana are extremely difficult. Is it plausible that a student would speak so to his teacher? And Rashi asked this problem by explaining what he said was, right, what are you doing, right, you're engaging in this frivolity, right, in this kalut rosh, for the sake of your desire. What is Rashi adding by that? And furthermore, Rav Kahana says it's Torah and I need to learn, but what does he learn? Nothing. All he learned is that his teacher behaves in a way he thinks is inappropriate. He doesn't seem prepared to learn from it. Okay.
I thought he was trying to learn what is appropriate behavior, you know, when you're alone with your wife.
Yeah, well, he doesn't seem to be willing to learn it.
I don't know. He may be surprised, amazed, but not necessarily critical.
I was wondering because he's expressing his havamina of that.
Mm-hmm. And you think that he learns the lesson?
He had the havamina that you should. That you speak about it as little as possible, and he's amazed to learn from Rob that there are times when it actually is appropriate to speak about it.
It's not a very respectful way to ask.
So amazed he can't wait until tomorrow to ask.
Apparently not. Yeah.
I don't know. The Afrikasta D'Anya goes out of his way to say that the following, that right, because of the importance of the topic and the greatness of the teacher and student, it seems right in my humble opinion to explain this on the basis of Rashi to Parshat Vayetze. Right, where he says, even the lightest of lightweights, that's Rashi's language, Kal Shabakalim doesn't speak thus. Right? I saw one of the holy ones say, the intent is that since Yaakov, our father, was entirely separated from physicality, and was unable to cleave to his wife until he grasped onto some light word, and he was compelled to this so he could have descendants. So, right? So Yaakov had to engage in this conversation because otherwise he couldn't bring himself into the physical world. So it was necessary for him. No, sorry, not Yaakov, I mean Rav, right, and he's going to say the same thing for Yaakov, yes. That Yaakov had to sort of bring himself back to physicality, and the only way to bring himself back to physicality was by speaking crudely, because otherwise he would have just stayed in the euphemistic world, where physicality didn't exist. Okay, So I wanted to begin, right, recognizing my own, recognizing the biases of my past, by trying to present a fair objective reading of it, which is that it's tough to read rabbinic tradition and claim that there are no circumstances under which one can use vulgar language, because you can, to create, come up with creative insults for idolatry. Right, and also apparently you can do it to express, right, to make extreme points. Right, you can use it at least in writing if you want to talk about the severity of the punishment which God is going to visit upon you. Right, so right, given a choice between saying tishkavna and tishagelna, the Torah wrote tishagelna. Right, now we can euphemize that by not reading it, only looking at it. Right, and decide what happens if you're in class. Right, whether right, in a ritual context, right, you don't recite it. But what you do in class, if you're studying Navi, right, it's a separate. But even if you don't, right, obviously you have to have it in your mind. So it's hard to make the claim that on a narrow halachic level that the issue is an absolute prohibition. Also, there seems to be some tension as to whether the issue of inappropriate speech about sexuality is because sex really shouldn't be there, and we just have to, and so we can think about it as little as possible, or sex is something so holy that we, right, that we shouldn't talk about it casually. Right, we shouldn't make it into a zemer. That's an objective presentation of the evidence. Now, I would, say background personally, I think it's really cool to live in a culture where after you go to the bathroom, you say a bracha. Right, and you say, right, you say, Asher Yatzar is an amazing thing. Right, you can say Asher Yatzar, right, and call it this physical description of excretion. Right, in the context of, really, it's pure holiness. Right, nobody has any thoughts of making it comic. Really, that's an amazing thing culturally. Right, it should be appreciated as to what it means to live in a culture like that. And I think that we should recognize that, for starters, I think we're better off if we say that the objection to constant use of vulgar language about sex is not so much purely that what are we doing talking about sex, it's the complete profanation of the sacred. Right? So at the point, if you ever try to have a conversation, if you listen to the worst excesses of rap, and then you pick up Shir HaShirim, like, it's kind of hard to make Shir HaShirim holy. Right, because you're going to have all sorts of of horrific stuff hanging on the back of your head on the same topic. It's how you ever think of sex as a metaphor for creation when you're culturally conditioned to see it largely as as an act of either self gratification or abuse is a really hard thing. So I think I'm most comfortable saying that the way to frame it is, as we started last week, that the premise is that one is supposed to be talking about Torah. Or talking about things that inspire one to Torah, or talking about things that inspire one to self-perfection. That's last week. So, therefore, all speech has to be justified, for starters, because speech is a gift. Secondly, we know how to justify speech. So speech which isn't serving a positive function, even though we spent a lot of time last week talking about social positive functions, not just about religious positive functions, has to be justified. And then we say that the notion that we should use speech to take either to wallow in acts of physicality that don't seem to have a sacred element, or worse, to take acts of physicality that have a sacred element and do our best to reduce them to the physical, is a breach of language. That said, we have to deal with halakha. Right? Halakha says you're allowed to make fun of avodah zarah in that way. I'm not going to talk about now whether it's whether it's purposeful to make zis jokes. right? And if it's not purposeful to make zis jokes, whether there are any religions nowadays about whom we would apply the halakha, I would tend to think probably not. But that's a separate conversation. But in principle, right, it means that we allow that there is no objection per se to using extremes to mock things that really need being mocked. Or again, you know, to give right, if you're giving a speech, if you're writing something like hell, right, where you really need to show how disastrous this is, there doesn't seem to be a formal halakhic objection to at least writing the language which is necessary to express, right, to express that emotion. But of course, if you use the same language to express, you know, to express anger because you stubbed your toe, then it's not going to mean anything anymore. Right? You know, that language is only meaningful in a culture where it's used as extreme rarity. So you preserve, right? You preserve the meaning of language for, right, for that extreme case. My, you know, if I were giving a, you know, a frame, you know, a mentoring framing for, right, for students in yeshiva, I would say it's hard for me to imagine for most people that it's ever necessary at all. It's become, you know, these are theoretical halakhic positions. But I think it's fair to recognize that most people aren't living lives in a pure yeshiva context where, and not everyone shares the same sensibility I do. So I think my take halakhically would be that the notion that not caring about it is a really bad thing. Not caring about it is an is a lack of sensitivity to the gift of language. Having been, once one notices that this is something one should care about, so then you have to ask the same question you do of all other complicated questions in life, right? Which is when you have hard choices, is this at all justified? Now there are people, you know, there are people who spend their time dealing with death and dying the whole time, and such people, if the only way they can live with it, right, is by using bad language, I might not want to be there, but it's hard, right, but it's hard for me to condemn them. There are people who use off-color humor for productive purposes. I think that the test I would set up, you know, large. I think again, you know, if you ask me as an idealist, I'm a much more comfortable in a world which doesn't have it. But I think if one is trying to give realistic guidance to a community, the real answer is that it's a very hard test to meet. Right? Not so many things are avodah zarah, such that it's worth saying this, right, to make fun of them. Right? Not so many emotions are so profoundly serious that you don't have other ways to express it. And if we ended up creating a culture which was not, which didn't live up to the Rambam, in which that, you know, whatever our native language was, it wasn't only loan words, right? But in which everyone felt that they had to justify every word they said, even if sometimes they ended up justifying things that, that wouldn't make primetime television. I think that it's hard to argue that isn't religiously acceptable. And truthfully, I think for the Rambam, the notion that if you create a culture where people just thought all the time that language was important, I think that would be enough of a success. And that's end of my share. Questions are welcome. Yes, Mark.
So I think that in some ways, in terms of sources, it may be a little more nuanced, because it seems like when there's just vulgar language, exploitive in a way that's especially used, like I go on the beach the other day, there's a couple out on the dock arguing, and the way I say we're using, I don't want my kids to hear that kind of. Versus what, you know, the Rob talking about, just talking about, you know, intimate, you know, even intimate, you know, talk amongst people may not be the way we talk about stuff, the top, you know, about a physical topic. There seems to be some, he has an objection to that, even if it's not what we call vulgar. And that's actually the source on the Rob. It seems to maybe address that. Because it doesn't mean that he was talking vulgar to his wife.
It might be
a difference between intimacy, something that should be intimate versus something that's vulgar and is used the way it's used in rap songs or whatever.
So it might be fair to say that Rav Kahana and the Rambam have a shared sensibility, right? In which they don't get the notion that this ever has a purpose. But Rav, and possibly the Ramban, and you know, I think the Gemara generally, understands that certain types of conversation are useful. Right, but only appropriate for married people, and only appropriate in the context of their bedroom. Right, and I think that in that regard, you know, halakha has some sensibility to the notion, right, that there are things that married people can address in ways that have an experiential context that makes it something other than vulgar, that teenagers ought not to be able to do.
But there are the two different value judgments. You know, whether you think that sex is just dirty all the time, or if words, how you use the words and their intent and the emotional content that is vulgar and dirty.
I think that's, you know, I say, I think that that's, but I think that it's very likely that for people who, right, for people who actually are in a sexual relationship, language can mean different things than for people who aren't and can't, right, have no cultural possibility of being in one legitimately. Right? And for people who have never had the experience, people who have had the experience, I think language, I think the associations with language, right, can be different or have to be different. Right? You can have been in the most vulgar of sexual relationships and then the language will forever be cheapened for you. Right? But it doesn't mean to create a context in which married couples, right? So the Rambam, maybe married couples can't talk to each other other than an extreme necessity about the nature of their physical relationship. But I don't think that's what the Gemara means. That's not what Rav Kahana means. I don't think you have to go so far as Rav Kahana Daniya and say that Rav Kahana only did this because he was such a holy man. Rav only did this because he was such a holy man that it was impossible, right? That he specifically had to do this. I think that words mean different things for different people in different contexts. Right, just as the same words, right, are obscene in one century and then those become the standard words in the next century and it rotates, right? You can have, there are all sorts of histories of, you know, of euphemisms, right, in the dictionary. But, you know, I think that that's, again, I start by saying that my own strong preference is to live in, you know, I still have something of an allergic reaction, particularly when adults like to try to establish false intimacy by inserting random obscenities into conversation. Right? It's a way of establishing intimacy. I have that, you know, it's the way bosses establish intimacy that way. Random salespeople establish intimacy that way. It's a way I can take that chance of saying this in front of you that shows that, you know, that we're friends. It generates an absolute allergic reaction in me. On the other hand, when I started working with teenagers, I realized that that was not a plausible way to work with teenagers. They didn't share every single bit of your cultural assumptions, and so I figured out a way to handle it. But I think that, you know, speaking from the context of tradition, or Senator's welcome to radically disagree with me if you want to. I think that a fairer description of the tradition is that I stand at one end of the spectrum, that the Gemara and the tradition are open to the possibility that there are people who have different sensibilities, but it's not open to the possibility of people using language casually, and it understands that there's a real cost in using this kind of language casually, both because you lose the meaning of certain things in real life and because you lose the meaning of language. And then if you have the Rambam's perception that language is a gift, and I think, you know, that I share with that, you know, I have no difficulty accepting that notion that language is a sacred gift, and in some sense the capacity to speak in language is being a Tzelem Elokim, with all the fact that there are some very smart parrots and an occasional chimpanzee. One's really smart parrot, right? An occasional chimpanzee that has, you know, that apparently have gotten up to 20... Pardon?
The octopus.
Is an octopus that was smarter? I don't know about the octopus. I know about the parrot.
Yeah, there were two really smart parrots. They're both dead.
Two really smart parrots. Okay, thank you. With all that, so I think that you know, the tradition sees that as a, you know, that that's real, right? Language is a gift. As opposed to the Rambam, I think we see certain kinds of physicality as gifts. The removal of meaning from language and the removal of the potential of meaning from sexuality are both tremendous costs. You know, I'm happy to go on the standard diatribe against contemporary culture, on the grounds that what our culture does often is it diminishes the possible meaning of physicality, and it diminishes all sorts of capacity for expression. You can frame that, hold on one second, right? You can frame that in a different context. Right? When I was, you know, one year I was the person who was stuck giving the Shmirat Negiah speech in Maimonides. Every once in a while I feel I need to do it. So the way I usually frame it is, you know, if you hold hands on a first date, then holding hands means we're on a first date. And, you know, you want to have expression, you want to try and figure out what it means to be in a committed relationship. Well, guess what? Your language of intimacy just got shortened dramatically. Right? There's not so much you can do. You have very few levels of intimacy you can express. Right? Whereas, if you only hold hands with your wife, then holding hands means a very different thing. And there's a real value in preserving, right, in preserving the maximal possibility, the maximal possibility of expression, and not to take things that could mean a lot and make them mean very little. I think that's the way I would, that's the way I would frame it. That's the way I would frame it mostly. I think that the sensibility of the Rambam and the Ramban that certain things maybe that's not talked about at all, that I think probably there are spectrums about. There's a spectrum about that. I fall on one end, but I wouldn't want to impose that as saying the Torah perspective. Right, yes, Mr. Mindick.
I think it depends who is saying what they're saying. That means everything. If somebody's going to the bathroom, or somebody's a young kid, he's coming out, and he can sound like an obscenity. An old man can go to the bathroom, he can come in, come out and praise God, and you see it as a bracha.
Yeah, so I think it's a big, I think it's really an amazing thing to make a bracha. I mean, I think that, you know, like, we should cling to that. That moment of what it means to be, right, a culture. We're not just old men, right, you know, who understand it. But even young people are trained, right, you know, to make brachos when they go to the bathroom.
But an older man makes a bracha, he comes out, he means it.
I think that's very likely. I think that's very likely. There's a lot of truth to that. But I think we should probably make that the epigraph. Can't help that one.
I heard somebody once say that never.